18th afternoon panel of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. I'm pleased to be joined today. I'm Rico Bishop, and I'm pleased to be joined by Francie Reedman. Judge Arburn will not be able to be with us, but he will participate on briefs. I understand that we're going to switch the first two cases, so we'll be starting with In Re Interest of KW. Let me remind you that we are live streaming through NET, and so to the extent there's any sensitive information or names that you might want to be using initials for or just first names, please keep that in mind, because these are recorded and preserved in archives for later access by the general public. All right, with that said, when I call your case up officially, please come to the podium. I'll say it again for the sake of the recording, and then we'll get started. So we'll begin with In Re Interest of KW. And again, this is In Re Interest of KW. You may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Locke. Excuse me. I am an assistant Douglas County public defender, and I represent the appellant, KW, in this matter. The question before the court today is whether a person can be considered so dangerous for purpose of the Sex Offender Commitment Act, such that forced inpatient treatment is the least restrictive alternative treatment plan when there is no evidence adduced that this person has or ever will commit a contact offense and has an intensive, structured, outpatient treatment plan upon release from confinement.
Where does the statute say it has to be a contact offense? Doesn't it say prior sex offense?
Correct, Your Honor. The standard for commitment under the Sex Offender Commitment Act is that the subject of the hearing needs to be likely to engage in repeat acts of sexual violence. I think violence implies a contact offense or a likelihood of a contact offense only in this matter.
Doesn't the statute actually define what likely to engage in repeat acts of sexual violence means?
It has been defined as that the subject has to have the propensity to commit sex offenses resulting in serious harm to others to such a degree as to pose a menace to the health and safety of the public.
So your position is the fact that he has 100-plus photos of children engaging in sexual acts is not harming anyone? The fact that he's an audience for that type of material?
No, that's not our contention here today. What our contention here today is that the likelihood of his reoffense is so low. On top of that, if he was to reoffend in this structured outpatient treatment plan that he was set up for upon release, there would be such oversight that, first off, there would not be a likelihood of offense, and second off, if there was a reoffense, the harm is so tangential and so far removed and so quickly to be discovered and handled appropriately that it doesn't meet the qualifications for confined inpatient treatment. In Re Interest of DH, the Nebraska Supreme Court stated, confinement of a mentally ill person lies in finding that a person is dangerous and that absent confinement, the mentally ill person is likely to engage in particular acts which result in substantial risk of harm to himself or others.
Wasn't it revealed in his psychological evaluation that he would have disturbing thoughts as he was looking at these pictures of very young children? I mean, some of those pictures were infants, a few years old, and that he would get off on that, right? And that he actually admitted in his evaluation that he had disturbing thoughts as he looked at those pictures. Doesn't that pose a threat if that's not treated?
First off, Your Honor, for the purposes of the Sex Offender Commitment Act, to have involuntary commitment, and especially in a confined arena, it would require more than just disturbing thoughts. It would require an actual dangerousness to the community. Two things about that. First off, I don't think that there is a dangerousness to the community, a dangerous of risk of violence to the community in an offense which the testimony shows if there was a reoffense, it wasn't going past the possession and depiction of these pictures. first off. Second off, while it may be an issue for society, for involuntary commitment, I don't believe it.
Okay, so you would agree, right, that both the experts that testified in this, or that presented evidence in this case, indicated that he was a dangerous sex offender. It was more an issue between voluntary or involuntary confinement, right?
It was more of an issue of inpatient or outpatient treatment, I think. Right. And I think you're right in that both the providers did make a determination medically that he did qualify as a dangerous sex offender.
I mean, even the witness you offered, correct?
That's correct, medically, yes.
With the propensity to reoccur?
She stated that he qualified as a dangerous sex offender, I believe. So that would...
Include that as well.
But I think it's important to look at that. Similarly, as the state argues that the factors that apply to the initial dangerousness, those risk assessments, those actuarial risk assessment tools that were used, apply not only to determine dangerousness, but that they also apply to determine least restrictive alternative. I think the same is said for this case and that initial determination of whether or not he is a dangerous sex offender. Even if he is a dangerous sex offender, I think it's important that we look at his convictions and his likelihood of reoffense and the lack of violence or the lack of contact or any sort of violence towards the community in that instance.
And do you think violence necessarily involves some type of physical contact?
I don't know if I'm comfortable stating a bright line rule that violence requires that, but I do think in this particular instance, when you look at the facts of this particular case, the violent harm is not direct from the subject of the hearing, right? I mean, the subject of the hearing maybe is presumed to be patronizing an industry that industry then harms, and it's presumed then that his patronizing of that industry will further that industry, but there is no actual direct violence, and direct violence, direct harm, or direct contact. Further, the argument is that even if he was to reoffend in this way, without that specific harm, and with the oversight he has, it would be discovered so quick, it's presumed to be discovered so quickly. I mean, his outpatient treatment plan involved not only him doing individual and group therapy every week, but living in a halfway house, a Christian halfway house for sex offenders, as well as having to have restriction on his internet access and taking polygraph tests.
It wasn't some of the concern here with regard to, well, do we have to go with inpatient versus can we do this outpatient that was proposed by Dr. Payne, right? Wasn't some of the concern here that while he was an inmate, he was involved in the iHelp program, and he wasn't able to complete that successfully because I think there was evidence that he had volatile relationships with staff and peers, he inconsistently demonstrated awareness of his mental health issues, he didn't cooperate with supervision, he even blamed his therapist for some things. So wasn't the concern that given he couldn't do that in a structured environment when he was an inmate, that how is it believable that he will voluntarily participate in the outpatient therapy that was described by Dr. Payne?
I think the outpatient therapy isn't voluntary. The determination of whether there's going to be a commitment is first determined by whether or not he qualifies as a dangerous sex offender. Then the board can force treatment, whether it's inpatient or outpatient, but either way, it has to be the least restrictive alternative plan. So that oversight in an outpatient setting, Dr. Payne would have to report to the board, would have to make sure to update them in her monthly reports, and actually has a duty to inform them if there's any sort of assessment there is.
Is it your position that if a doctor comes in and provides a lesser restrictive alternative, an outpatient program, does that always prevail if it's contrary to another doctor's recommendation for inpatient? The fact that another doctor has said there is another alternative,
No, I...
Is that automatic?
I don't believe so. If you look at the case of, I think specifically a good case to look at would be In Re Interest OS for that, because it's not so much that there is, if a doctor comes in and testifies, well, this is what it, this is another plan, and so come this way. It's whether or not the state can prove by clear and convincing evidence that inpatient would be the least restrictive treatment alternative. And I think OS is a case where evidence of that wasn't presented to the board, that Dr. Neuring in that case did not testify as to any sort of outpatient treatment. And the Supreme Court had found, because he didn't know about any programs, they can't, the state can't say that there's been clear and convincing proof that inpatient is the least restrictive alternative because we don't know about outpatient programs. So, and I think similarly, we have to look and see if the state carried its burden to show that inpatient was the least restrictive alternative when there was an available outpatient program waiting for him. It's not necessarily that they would always prevail. I think it's a matter of determining that. And if you look at that, Dr. Payne has run that program for quite some time, the testimony shows. Dr. Payne not only has experience in inpatient treatment, but in outpatient treatment too, which is not the case with Dr. Levinson, who is the one recommending inpatient treatment.
So your position is really that there should have been more weight given to Dr. Payne's recommendations than Dr. Levinson's?
I wouldn't necessarily frame it as a matter of weight given. I mean, I do think that Dr. Payne was a more credible witness because of her background. I think what is troubling is that if you look at the district court's order, which is the order being appealed here, there's not even a mention of Dr. Payne in that order. It seems as though the district court didn't even consider that evidence. And I think that's what's more troubling. I see that I'm out of time, so I would just ask if there's any more questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Otherwise, if I can just wrap up with my final prayer, I pray this court find the district court's order was not supported by clear and convincing evidence and overturn the district the Board of Mental Health's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Wells, and I'm a Deputy Douglas County Attorney. Here on behalf of the Mental Health Board of the 4th Judicial District, I have to apologize to this court. I found out this morning that I have a strep throat.
Oh.
My throat hurts from talking today.
Okay, let's raise our little screen.
I'll step back. I think really what this case comes down to is the least restrictive alternative. Dr. Levinson and Dr. Payne both testified that KW is a dangerous sex offender. They both found that he does suffer from a mental illness and that, you know, that he met the qualifications of a dangerous sex offender. Really, like I said, what comes down to is what the least restrictive alternative is.
Where can you tell me, where does the consideration of sexually violent acts come under?
As under the statute or in this case?
In the application of this case.
The sexually violent acts, I think Dr. Levinson, what he found is the sexually violent acts is the progression that KW had progressed from window peeping and masturbating to obtaining these child pornography images and the masturbation that he admitted to, having the thoughts and the things associated with that. And I think that progression led Dr. Levinson to conclude that KW has the propensity to engage in sexual violence going forward. I think Dr. Levinson also used the actuarial tools, the static 99 and the stable 2000, the stable along with the SORAG, concerns for Dr. Levinson, and specifically the stable, was that KW tested at a 15 of 26 back in 2015. When he went back and looked at the 2013 assessment, KW also scored a 15. This concerned Dr. Levinson because when you're in treatment for 2 years, Dr. Levinson would expect that score to decrease, to lessen based on your knowledge, your application of the material in the sex offender treatment. Dr. Levinson, I think, also was correct in having concerns with KW not completing the iHealth program. And I think that goes to one of the main reasons why Dr. Levinson did not recommend an outpatient commitment in this case, that inpatient was the least restrictive alternative, that He is in custody. This is an area where he can do this treatment in a locked facility. Dr. Levinson stated that the concerns were that the impulsivity that KW showed, the personality disorders, lack of motivation, his treatment interfering behaviors, interfering with the treatment of others. And I think that plays a major role in Dr. Levinson's recommendation for the least restrictive alternative. The thing that I would like the court to consider as well is that in this Schwerding versus Nebraska versus Liquor Control Commission, that this court may consider the fact that the board, sitting as the trier of fact, saw and heard the witnesses and observed the demeanor while testifying and can give weight to the board's judgment as to the credibility given to each witness. I have great respect for Dr. Payne. I've used Dr. Payne in the past. She's one of the best outpatient treatment providers, not only in this state but in the region. But I think in this case, the board gave the appropriate weight to Dr. Payne and to Dr. Levinson in finding that inpatient treatment was the least restrictive alternative. No other questions?
Thank you.
Go get some penicillin.
Thank you.
There you go.
I think we already went over your rebuttal time, if I'm not mistaken. So thank you both very much, and the matter is submitted. All right, we'll let them get out the door, and the next case will be parking management.